Thank you. Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate that generous introduction. I'm grateful to the Harvard Law School Forum for the invitation that has brought us together. And I thank each and all of you for that warm welcome and this opportunity for me to meet and to talk with you. I'll be quite brief to leave you plenty of opportunity to quiz me, cross-examine me, and offer me advice if you wish. Anybody running for the presidency needs that. When I ran for the Senate in California in 1968, my opponent was a man named Max Rafferty, whom some of you might vaguely recall. He was an extreme right-wing alleged educator. And in the course of that campaign, he was trying to establish that I was the most liberal person who'd ever sought public office, and he the most conservative. His people went around California quoting George Bernard Shaw's definition of a liberal as somebody with both feet firmly implanted in midair. Then they tried to apply that to me. They also developed a slogan in keeping with that theme, which was, "Our Max sure has both feet on the ground." I went around California trying to counteract that by quoting an American sage, Joey Lewis, who once said, "Show me a man with both feet on the ground, and I'll show you a man who can't put his pants on." With that high-level campaign, I got elected to the Senate. When you run for president, you learn a lot about yourself. I read in the Boston Globe a little while ago that I am bald. I want you all to know I had a full head of hair until Ronald Reagan became our president. I've developed a theory about the presidency after watching and working with presidents at very close hand during the 15 years that I've been in the Senate. I believe that a president should focus the power of his or her mind on one or two principal purposes. Otherwise, a president is overwhelmed and distracted by the event of the moment and the crisis of the day, and there are many. There's no sense of direction. The president just becomes a manager of whatever forces its way onto the agenda. I'm focusing in my campaign, and I intend to concentrate in the White House, on two principal purposes. First, I will do all a president can do to end the arms race and avert the danger of nuclear war. And second, I will do all a president can do to straighten out the economy and lead us to full employment, a job for every American who wants and needs a job. Plainly, many other issues are of vast significance. Education, the need to pay all teachers more, the need to elevate the prestige of the profession of education to its rightful place at the very forefront of our society, the need to achieve excellence in the classroom, the environment, the need to get rid of toxic waste and acid rain. We've gotten rid of James Watt, now we have to get rid of the architect of his policies, Ronald Reagan. Thank you. The need to protect wild rivers and beautiful seascapes like Cape Cod and the Big Sur and Mendocino Coast of California, to protect wildernesses and parks. Equal opportunity, the need to enact ERA and to abolish discrimination against women, blacks, Hispanics, and all others subjected to discrimination in our society. But if we blow ourselves up in a nuclear war, none of these issues will really matter. And if we fail to straighten out our economy, we will not really have the capacity to cope with many of these issues that require some treasure as well as time and talent. So peace and jobs really are paramount. I've spelled out in great detail in the course of my campaign the steps that I believe can lead us to full employment. In tight essence, they comprise the following. First, we need a fiscal policy designed to lead us toward balanced budgets once again. They can't be achieved overnight, but if we simply establish that that's where we're headed, confidence will be restored, and we will begin to develop the capacity to get interest rates down, which we must, and to have the resources to deal with unfunded domestic needs. A balanced budget can best be achieved, I believe, in three ways. One, restoring taxes on those who are no longer paying their fair share due to the premature and excessive Reagan-Kemp-Roth tax cuts. Two, eliminate needless military expenditures, like the MX missile system, and negotiate with the Soviets in an effort to make far deeper cuts, mutual and verifiable, possible. Three, the best way, most pleasant, least painful to balance the budget, is to get Americans back to work so that they are earning money, paying taxes, and no longer needing food stamps, unemployment compensation, and other forms of assistance to the victims of unemployment. For every 1 million people we put back to work, we reduce the deficit by about $30 billion. So if we can get 6 million or something like that people now unemployed back to work, we can move swiftly toward a balanced budget. The next policy we need is a wise monetary policy, which means revising the policies of the Federal Reserve Board to permit a slow, steady, predictable growth of the money supply, with emphasis on getting interest rates down rather than combating inflation. There's a better way to deal with inflation, and that leads to the third element of the policy, an economic policy focusing on jobs and on the human element in the economy. Business will, of course, always focus on profits. Government should place its emphasis on jobs and on the human element. In otherwise meaning, job training, retraining, education, fostering programs that deal with productivity by giving workers a stake in what they produce through profit sharing, bonuses for productivity, stock options, and the like. I believe we need a national industrial bank that will provide low interest rate loans like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation during the Depression, which worked very well then, to ensure that production and jobs will be brought to central cities, communities, and regions where production and jobs are lacking. That body should work with the Energy Department to see to it that to supplant our dangerous and costly reliance on Arab oil and nuclear energy, that we develop domestic, non-polluting, non-depletable forms of energy like solar, biomass, geothermal, and wind energy, needed if we are to be able to make our economy hum without extravagant and uncertain energy sources. We need the government to work as the Japanese government works and as Germany's government works, with exporters, both from factory and farm, to assist in penetrating foreign markets. And we need to ensure that if we are denied entrance to foreign markets or discriminated against, that those countries will face like barriers in our country, the objective to lower tariff barriers, not to raise them. I believe that those steps, with others like them, can lead to full production and full employment. However, it's very difficult to straighten out the economy while we are involved in this incredibly costly arms race. Ronald Reagan's budget for military matters for the next 5 years is $3 trillion. And how we can throw all that money at the military and expect to get toward a balanced budget and have enough left over in public or private hands to educate, to deal with the environment, to deal with housing needs and transportation needs and infrastructure needs, to clean up the air, to clean up the water, to have adequate soil conservation, and deal with all the other unmet needs of our society. It's hard to figure out why we have such an extravagant military budget. And one of the prime reasons the Japanese and the Germans are outdoing us economically now is that while we pay for so much of their defense, they invest in competition with us and others in the world's markets. While our best brains, many of them in the scientific world, are siphoned off to the arms race because of the cost-plus aspect of defense contracting, which means very lavish salaries and profits, the best scientific brains in Japan and Germany tend to go off into producing steel, automobiles, transistors, TV sets, and the like, and outdoing us in our own markets and in many realms that we originally started. Even worse, of course, than what the arms race does to our economy is the dire danger that it will culminate in a nuclear war. Not that we or the Soviets will deliberately start one, neither of us are that foolish. But there's the grave danger of an accident, a miscalculation, a computer error, a radar mistake, or an escalation up of a conflict that starts in the Middle East or Central America or elsewhere and gets out of hand and leads inexorably up to a nuclear holocaust that no one wants and no one intends. I believe that we are entering one of the most dangerous periods in the history of the world right now. Relations between the United States and the Soviet Union are incredibly strained. We blame them, they blame us. We can't look to them for new leadership. We have to look to ourselves. As far as responsibility, I share the American view that Soviet actions have contributed much more to this deterioration of relations than have our actions. But we have contributed our part. As to leadership, we presently do not know who leads the Soviet Union. Yuri Andropov has been totally out of sight now for more than 100 days. So who's making the decisions and who we are supposed to deal with is unknown in Washington and in other world capitals. What about us? What about our leadership? For the next 14 months, the United States will be led by a man who thinks the way to solve every complicated problem is to send in the Marines. A man who views the use of force not as a last resort, as it should be viewed, but as the very first and preferable resort. I believe that Ronald Reagan's worldview, if it can be called that, is fundamentally wrong. It's a view that has now involved us simultaneously, directly or indirectly, in four wars: Lebanon, Grenada, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. It's a simplistic, superficial, and I think a paranoid view of the world. It sees the Soviets as the source of all our problems. Poverty? Ronald Reagan doesn't seem to know that it exists. Right-wing tyranny? Ronald Reagan ignores it. This president shows not the slightest hint of distress over the fact that Soviet-American relations have reached their most dangerous point since the Berlin blockade and the Cuban Missile Crisis. And involved in all of this are these weapons of absolutely massive destructive capacity, poised and aimed, ours at them, theirs at us, under a hair-trigger situation. And yet this president opposed every major treaty and effort by every preceding Republican and Democratic president to deal with arms control. And in the first year of his administration, there was nothing but bellicose rhetoric about the Soviets, about fighting limited nuclear wars, about winning nuclear wars, and firing warning nuclear shots in the air. It wasn't until Ronald Reagan's second year in the White House that he even took an arms control negotiating position. And it was a hopelessly one-sided position. Great for us, absolutely unacceptable if you were a Soviet. In the first 10 months of his third year, this year, President Reagan has publicly changed his negotiating position four times. None of these proposals would effectively curb the massive buildup now going up in our arsenal and in the Soviet nuclear arsenal. Ronald Reagan seems to see arms control negotiations as propaganda contests with the Soviet Union to be carried on in the public prints and over radio and television for diplomatic and military purposes, not for arms control accomplishments. You well know that if you want to negotiate, you don't do it basically through the public prints. You do it in private and in a meaningful, direct way. Ronald Reagan seems to see arms control negotiations as opportunities also to achieve military advantage over the Soviet Union, not as a forum for seeking to achieve common solutions to common problems that confront us both. Richard Burt, one of the key architects of present American so-called arms control policy, recently said this: "The purpose of this whole exercise is maximum political advantage. It is not arms control we're engaged in." The president's first appointment as director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, the body supposedly in charge of developing a sensible arms control policy, was Eugene Rostow. He came before the Foreign Relations Committee where I sit. We asked him many questions, and one was, Mr. Rostow, if nuclear war came, how disastrous would it be? And he replied, quote, I've never forgotten his response, well, Japan not only survived but flourished after the bombs fell. I proceeded to vote against him. He was confirmed, but he was subsequently fired by Ronald Reagan because he was apparently too pro-arms control, despite his lack of concern about the disaster that a nuclear war would be. He was replaced by Ken Edelman. Ken Edelman had ridiculed arms control predecessors in that office, stating that they were hysterical and that mushroom clouds danced in their heads, nightmares of mushroom clouds danced in their heads. And he said that we should engage in arms control efforts, but we really would not and should not be serious about them. That's the Reagan approach to arms control. And now, in the increasingly dangerous atmosphere in which we find ourselves, it's become between ourselves and the Soviet Union's tit for tat. They started the present round of an escalation in the arms race in Europe, the Soviets did, by modernizing the SS-20s and putting in more and more of them. We have now responded by putting cruisers and Pershings in Europe, a new step in the arms race, and they in turn respond by announcing that they are going to put submarines closer to our shore and target us in ever more dangerous ways. Round and round it goes, and worse it all gets. I believe that our responsibility, since we can't expect the Soviet people, who are helpless, to determine their own fate, to provide leadership on this front, our responsibility is to seek to stop this president, stop him from invading Nicaragua, stop him from further military involvement in El Salvador, stop him from further military involvement in the Middle East, stop him from escalating the arms race. He wants he's not only taken steps that further escalated in Europe, he wants to carry it on off into space with a so-called Star Wars approach, which would cost us trillions of dollars and lead, I am absolutely convinced, to greater insecurity rather than more security. Before any further steps are taken in this arms race, we need a great national debate on the subject of nuclear war and how to stop it. The most serious, concentrated debate that we've had since the debates that preceded the election of Abraham Lincoln and the discussion of what it took to preserve our Union while checking slavery. I've been involved in this issue of nuclear war ever since 1945, when the bombs fell at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I met Albert Einstein then. He educated me in the dangers of nuclear war. Einstein warned that a nuclear war could destroy the environment that sustains life on this planet and thus annihilate totally and forever the human family. That may sound extreme. I checked recently with the head of Caltech, the former head of MIT, Jerome Wiesner, and with a Nobel laureate type scientist in every major discipline. One of them was Carl Sagan. And I asked them a single question. Is it the current view in your discipline of science that a nuclear war could annihilate human life on this planet? The unanimous answer was yes. We do not know that it would, but we know it could, and there's no way we can conduct experiments to ascertain the truth. What the annihilation of the human family would mean has been spelled out eloquently by Jonathan Schell, a brilliant young American writer, author of The Fate of the Earth, in these words, we risk surrendering ourselves to an absolute and eternal darkness, a darkness in which no nation, no civilization would remain, a darkness in which never again would a child be born, a darkness in which never again would human beings appear on earth, and there would be no one to remember that they ever did. If we permit that to happen, we commit the ultimate moral mortal sin of destroying God's creation. As George Kennan recently stated it, we risk not only putting an end to civilization, but also destroying the entire product of humanity's past efforts. The cities, the art, the learning, the mastery of nature, the philosophy. This civilization is not the property of one generation alone. We are only the custodians. It is not our achievement. It is the achievement of others. We did not create it. It was bestowed upon us with the obligation to cherish, to preserve, to develop, to pass on to the others who are supposed to come after us. That need not be our fate. Human beings created these weapons. Certainly human beings are capable of controlling them. But we have not now embarked upon that course. There's one other element that we should consider, moral and ethical. As Randall Keeler, the national coordinator of Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign, has put it, the most fundamental flaw in our present policy is moral and ethical. Our security as a nation should not be based on the threat to annihilate millions of men, women, and children who have done nothing to us in any way, but whose government happens to be our enemy. Unquote. I would add that those people did not choose their government. It was imposed upon them by force. Yet we have them targeted. Every resident, man, woman, child, and infant of Moscow, Leningrad, and every other Soviet city, ready to wipe them out if the Soviets commit an act of nuclear aggression against us. And if it comes to that, it could be the end not only of our country, but their country and the entire world. This need not be our fate. Human beings created these weapons. Human beings are certainly capable of controlling them. But we are not now embarked upon that course. What is needed is an all-out effort, the like of which we've never undertaken, to end this folly before it ends us. What is needed is an all-out effort to negotiate with the Soviets, starting with them, then going on to other nations, but starting with the Soviets, to end this folly before it ends us. I know it will not be easy to negotiate with the Soviets. Years of suspicion, hostility, and failure lie behind us. I have no illusions about them. They are aggressive, repressive. They do not understand, nor do they value freedom. But Ronald Reagan's apparent impression to the contrary, they are human beings with their own fears and hopes and dreams, their own families, children, and grandchildren to be concerned about. They do know the dangers. I was in Moscow a bit ago. While there, I met with many Soviet leaders. One of them was Marshal Nikolai Ogarkov. He is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Soviet Union, their number one military man, the man whose job it would be to destroy us if war came. We had a long conversation, and in the course of it, I put to him this question. Marshal, if it came to nuclear war between your country and mine, could anybody win? And he replied in three words, no. Mutual suicide. They know the dangers. And so, incidentally, do little American children. Since I've been speaking out on this issue in the national arena, I've started receiving the most plaintive, appealing letters from little kids in our country crying out, are you really going to do something about nuclear war? I want to grow up. One little girl, only 9 years old, wrote down her impression of what the world would be like after a nuclear war. And these were her words. It would probably be very smoky and not many people and lots of things ruined and dark. A little boy named Quelli, only 6 years old, had this to say. It's like they don't know how to stop. They just keep making more and more. They should talk to their child about it. So when they grow up, they won't do what the big people are doing now. I say that it's absolutely irresponsible for we, the big people, to let this lethal nightmare hang over our children, darkening their days and filling their nights with fear. We can overcome. We must overcome. And yet, under every American president since 1945 and under every Soviet leader since 1945, we've slipped closer and closer and closer to the abyss. No president has ever given this danger to all of us, to all that we hold dear, the absolute priority attention it requires. I intend to do so. No one else within reach of the presidency, and it is within my reach, has a background on this issue going all the way back to 1945 and Albert Einstein. I have that background and the commitment stemming from it. If you want a president who will focus as no one ever yet has on this matter, on this danger, then lend me a hand in this race for the presidency, starting with the Massachusetts primary, which is a very significant one because it comes early in a key state in our nation, and starting also up in New Hampshire, where you could help in the canvassing that can help us determine who would vote for me in that all-important first primary. If I do well in the early tests, I will do well in the later tests, and that is the path to the presidency. It could be, it just could be, that working together, we could transform the world. I thank you for what you will do, and I urge you onwards. Thank you very, very much. Thank you, Mike. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much. Yes.
Yes, Senator, I'm wondering what sort of an impact the nuclear freeze would have on American conventional ports, specifically the defense budget, and also would it mean a return to draft?
Well, the nuclear freeze would not, and an agreement to start building down nuclear weapons, would not have profound impact on the military budget. 80% of what we invest in military matters goes to conventional weaponry and related matters. But I would not be content with just achieving arms control agreements on nuclear weapons. I would hope that rather than having to build up our conventional strength as an alternative deterrent to the nuclear deterrent, that we could reach agreements with the Soviets to start reducing conventional weaponry too. They need it as much as we do. Their economy suffers the same pangs and pains from the arms race as we, and I believe that could be accomplished. I would therefore hope that we would not have to spend more, but spend less, and that we would have no need to go to the draft. I supported the draft in 1939. When Hitler was on the march, I was convinced we were going to have a war with him, and I personally gave up a deferment and enlisted in the army at that time. But we are presently meeting our military personnel needs by the volunteer army. I think we all know we're meeting it in part by conscription, by poverty. When we achieve full employment, it may be a different matter. But we have to try to find ways to reduce those needs, and we have to find ways to create the spirit of volunteerism in our country, not only for military, but for domestic alternative service. And if we do that, we will never have to go to the draft. I hope we will never have to again, certainly not in peacetime. And incidentally, I am absolutely against making student loans contingent upon registering for a draft that we do not need.
I have two questions. First of all, for all of Reagan's defense policy, has given no credit to bills to execute his own ideas. First question would be, how do you rate your ability to execute good intentions? And the second question would be, there's another saying, you marry the bride, you marry the bride's family. And Reagan's family came to what all the other members of his family have caused many more problems.
Well, first, Ronald Reagan has been somewhat successful in getting his program across by his super salesmanship, and he is good at that. That's why he's won every election he's contested thus far. And because of the seeming great popularity, he was able to handle Congress effectively in his first 2 years. He's had much more trouble in the last year in getting his way in Congress. I believe that I can deal with Congress effectively, because I've had years of experience before I was in Congress working on Congress on various issues that concern me. I'm the only candidate for the presidency elected to a leadership role in the Congress. I've learned how to build coalitions, find votes, work with everybody, and get legislation through, and I think that background would enable me to be successful from the White House in dealing with the many people I know very well in the House and in the Senate. When you ask about the family, I presume you're asking about members of the cabinet and so forth. I am not ready, and I think it would be premature to start naming names, but I've had a lot of administrative experience in business and in state government, as well as in Congress now. You gain some administrative experience there too, because it's become such a huge operation. I've learned how to delegate. I believe in delegating to people who are capable and who would share my vision, my philosophy, my views. I want to concentrate, as I've indicated, on peace and on jobs. So I would want the most capable people in the country working with me in other realms, to whom I would delegate a lot of responsibility, although I would be working closely with them. I would not surround myself, as Jimmy Carter did, primarily by people from my home state, and as Ronald Reagan did to a considerable degree. I would reach all over the country for the best men and women and blacks and Hispanics and others who have not yet been adequately represented in our government, who would be capable of fulfilling the needs and hopes of our country. There are many qualified people. Just to give one example, Jerome Wiesner, the president emeritus of MIT, is my number one advisor on arms control matters. Yes.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about social inequality. It's one thing, I guess, there's not full answer to that. There are people who can and won't work on social security, welfare, systems, and whatnot, and there is the unemployment problem over many, several years since you were president. How do you deal with hunger and poverty and poverty that
Of course, jobs are a major answer to hunger and poverty. If you also job train and retrain and educate people so they can hold down jobs in our ever more complicated society, you do need adequate health care for those who do not have it, so that people will be healthy enough to work. And that can do away with many of the expenditures that are presently involved in sustaining in some decency and some comfort in their lives those who are unable to find jobs and take care of themselves. Hunger is a major problem. If people have incomes, many can deal with that problem. If people have no incomes, they need help. And I think one basic objective we should pursue in agricultural policy is, instead of the immoral and unwise policy of paying farmers or inducing farmers not to grow food and not to produce to their maximum in a world of vast hunger and starvation and consequent unrest, and in a nation where we now have malnutrition rising for the first time in a generation, we should find a way to enable farmers to grow all they can and assure them of a reasonable crack at a stable income and a decent profit in return. And for those who cannot afford to buy their food in our country, we should have school lunch programs and senior nutrition programs and other programs to help need them. We should find ways to give people incentives to work rather than to be on assistance programs. But I'm convinced that most Americans would prefer to be working if they can. And you notice that every time an advertisement appears saying we need 500 employees to do this or that, there are longer lines of people, thousands of people line up for those jobs. People want to work, they cannot find those opportunities now. Yes?
Senator, the problem with the vice presidency election played in Canada, once they received the nomination, we were treated with a 72, where George the government lost his running mate and he gave the job away without pressing you, and I assume you would pick a qualified person without regard to race, creed, color, national origin, or sex, yes, as long as that person were not from California. What observations do you have about running mate?
Well, first, it has to be thought out before you get to the convention. And because I expect to get to that convention and win the nomination, I am devoting a lot of thought to a running mate, although I'm devoting more thought to getting there in the first place, I will confess. Yes, it should be a person chosen for ability, regardless of race, sex, color, creed. I would want to recommend to the Democratic Convention someone, first of all, who would be a great president. Secondly, someone who would be a great vice president. Third, someone who would be a great campaigner. Fourth, someone who would basically share my philosophy. I'm not about to nominate someone to balance the ticket who is not that convinced about peace or jobs or the environment or equal opportunity or anything else. And I'm giving very serious thought to seeking to find the best qualified woman and making such a recommendation. I do not commit to that course. It would be premature to do so. But the time has come for a female vice president as well, not this year when I'm running, but soon thereafter for a female president of our country. Yes?
One of the alarming things going on now in Central America is the lack of any high visibility political opposition to policy, the illegal intervention in Grenada, the intervention in Nicaragua and El Salvador. To what extent are you willing to make Central America a central issue of this campaign, opposing both Democratic and Republican candidates who will favor the actions that we've seen in the last few weeks? And what is your policy on the President of the U.S.?
Well, I'm not only willing to make Central America a major issue, I have already done so. Let me give you a little bit of history. On the day, on the Sunday after the Saturday night when the Marines were killed, so many of them in Lebanon, I was in California. I was awakened Sunday morning early by a phone call from Washington to tell me about that tragic event. I spent a good part of the day trying to learn about it, making some comments, flew back to Washington Monday, got to bed about 11 o'clock. My phone rang at 1 a.m. from the White House. I was invited to a meeting with the president in the cabinet room at 8 a.m. that Tuesday morning with other congressional leaders with the president. I went down assuming we were to be told what's happening in Lebanon and what we're going to do about it. To my astonishment, the president never mentioned Lebanon and proceeded to tell us that he had invaded Grenada the night before. And that's the word he used, invasion. The president said that we did it to save American lives, the students at that medical college, and we did it because we were invited in by the Organization of East Caribbean States. That seemed to me to be a little bit contradictory. If we had to save American lives, we didn't need to be invited in by the heads of other nations. The president, when asked, said, "We think the fighting will be over in 24 hours. It went on for about 10 days, and two of our people were wounded last week by sniper fire. We asked, how long will the Marines and Rangers be there? And the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who were all there, indicated, well, probably the fighting will be over soon and we can get out within a week. That has now been abandoned. We are going to be there until at least December 23rd and maybe longer. The President never mentioned the fact that Maggie Thatcher, in whose realm we were invading, disapproved, and he never mentioned the Cubans or the Russians and their designs allegedly on that island. Later that day, I came out against the invasion, and I did not change my position when it became apparent that the American people generally supported the invasion. I think it was an outrage. I'm convinced it was not needed. I'm convinced it was not needed to save the lives of the students. As a matter of fact, it has been established that the State Department got in touch with the president and the vice chancellor of that medical school and said, please invite us in to save the students. And they refused. They said, no, we don't think the students are in danger. I believe, although I do not know, that we originated the request from the Organization of East Caribbean States. I think we drafted it. I don't know that, but I believe that, to invite us in. Later, it was discovered that there were some weapons there on the island, and that then became the excuse for the invasion, as if we invaded the island to find out a reason for invading the island. Most of those weapons were antiquated, or at least many of them, antiquated rifles from the last century. There were no weapons there that threatened your way of life or my security. And if there were weapons there, perhaps they were there because they began to fear that we were to invade them. That idea was afloat for several months in the Caribbean. We violated the War Powers Act, international law, the norm of relations between civilized nations, the OAS Charter, and the UN Charter in that action. It should not have been done. In Central America, we are violating many like laws and norms of behavior. In the absolutely improper, covert effort to overthrow the government of Nicaragua, we should stop it. And we are backing a ruthless regime in El Salvador that has been responsible for the death of over 30,000 political opponents, most of them unarmed, most of them killed with American arms and ammunition. What do we stand for when we back that kind of a regime? It blurs the American image of being for democracy and freedom, and we should stop it. We should tell that government, either you shape up on human rights, or we are going to stop all aid to you. The policy of backing tyrants in Central America and elsewhere does not work. It leaves no democratic middle ground. We backed Batista in Cuba. We got Castro. We installed and backed the Somoza tyranny in Nicaragua. We got the Sandinistas. In Vietnam, we backed right-wing Saigon, and we got left-wing Hanoi. The trouble with Ronald Reagan's policy is that he views every international difficulty as communist-inspired. The fact is that there was turmoil and tragedy and violence in Central America, long, of course, before Ronald Reagan was born, but also before the Russian Revolution. The origins of the problems there lie in poverty and in tyranny. And too often we have been indifferent to the poverty and have backed the tyrants. I visited the four Contadora countries. Off the coast of Panama, months ago, and came up with an alternative policy to a military solution in Central America. They recommend, those four countries are Panama, Mexico, Venezuela, Colombia. They recommend that we, all of us, stop military intervention in the affairs of Central America. That means ourselves and the Cubans. They recommend that we withdraw military advisors. They recommend that Central American nations stop permitting their land to be used as territory to attack a neighbor. They urge that we start giving economic aid to the impoverished and to the countries that can use it effectively, rather than military arms, and they urge progress within those countries toward freedom and democracy and pluralism. I support that alternative to the Reagan policy. The most dangerous thing Ronald Reagan does is see each of these conflicts, like Lebanon, as fundamentally East-West Soviet American, and plainly they are not. In Lebanon, there's been turmoil and bloodshed for decades. Muslims fighting and killing Muslims, Muslims fighting and killing Christians, Muslims fighting and killing Jews. And to suggest that that is all Soviet-inspired is an incredibly simplistic, superficial view of the world. And if we insist on viewing every conflict as Soviet-American, that may lead to an American-Soviet conflict and the ultimate Holocaust. Yes.
Before your last question here, my name is Kelly Moran. I'm the National Youth Coordinator with the Cranston Campaign. And I have here some cards that we'd like you to fill out so that we can keep you informed about what's happening within the Cranston Campaign, and hopefully most of all that you'll check the box saying that you're willing to help us out. And so we'll circulate these right now around the room, and we'd appreciate if you'd fill them out and drop them off at the door if you leave. In Massachusetts, we have many projects going on right now, and in New Hampshire, we're beginning a student canvassing project that will be going on between now and the primary in February. And we'd appreciate any help we can get. Thank you very much, Senator.
I guess we have time for one more question, and you've been trying to get my attention, so let me go to you.
Senator, thanks. I will appoint the appointment of the video. Thank you all, given
I don't think that's the proper way to create the atmosphere for successful negotiations. I do recognize that we cannot reach an arms control agreement that is based simply upon trusting them to live up to it. And we don't have to do that. What we can do is verify any arms control agreement, and the Senate would insist, and any president would insist upon that, by our own means, and we can. By satellite photography, which is incredible in what it reveals about what's going on down here on Earth, by infrared, radar, radio, seismographs, other technologies, and secret agents, we know what they are doing, they know what we are doing. And if anybody violates an arms control agreement, the other side would find out so swiftly that that violation would not pose any danger to the side that was living up to the terms of the agreement. We need to change the atmosphere, however. I think it's terrible that Ronald Reagan has not said word one, direct, eye to eye, with the Soviet leader since he became president, while we drive each other toward a Holocaust. There has not been a real serious discussion on this issue between the American president and the Soviet leader for 8 years, and that is incredible. If you sit down and start talking, you begin to create understanding, and that can lead to some trust. And we need that, although we cannot rely upon it totally, but we need a change atmosphere if we are to make progress. And that requires not only a president willing to engage in that, as I am, but it requires the support of the American people and a mandate from the American people in an election to go ahead and do that. And it requires an understanding that while the Soviets do many things that that we do not like and that we view as threatening, we're not going to reform them. They are not going to become angels. We have to recognize that we live in the same world with them, and our responsibility is to find a way with them to manage our relationship, to handle it, so that despite our differences, we do not let those differences explode into a nuclear war. Let me close by saying one more thing. I know that if you want to be engaged in political activity in this very important and significant election, you want to help someone with whom you find yourself in general agreement on the issues, but you also want to help someone who has a reasonable chance to win the nomination and beat Ronald Reagan. So let me go into that just a little bit. Where is my campaign? Where does it stand? The polls show Walter Mondale out front, but I am comforted by the fact that the opinion polls in the year before the election have not picked the winner of the Democratic nomination since 1956. With clockwork regularity, the front runner has fallen by the wayside. You'll remember most recently, Muskie, 72, Humphrey, 76, and Massachusetts, Ted Kennedy in 1980. All ahead in the opinion polls, but none of them winning the nomination. So thank God I'm not yet the leader in the opinion polls. The straw polls taken at state conventions like that in Massachusetts are a better indication of what is happening, because they are conducted after there's a contest, a campaign, and the people voting in those straw polls have a chance to size up the candidates and judge them, measure them before they vote. As was stated in the introduction, there have been six I've competed in. I won three, took second in three. Mondale won the other three, took second in two that I won. So I competed on an even basis with him and led John Glenn and all the others in every single straw poll that I entered, and I entered virtually all of them. Where I stand more specifically is here. I'm third in money. Mondale's first, Glenn second. I'm a strong third. I'm now gaining on them, and I will have enough come January 2 when I get matching money to compete on an even basis with them in the early primaries. They cannot outspend me in the early tests. I'm second in organization. Mondale ranks first. I'm a close second. Glenn is way behind. He has really no organization at all. And I believe I'm even with Mondale in organization in the key states, Iowa, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Maine, those that speak first. I'm first in three categories. I'm convinced I'm first in energy. I've got more of that than anybody in the race except maybe Jesse Jackson. And that's a crucial factor. I'm first in message. I have a clear, strong message, peace and jobs, and the relevance of all other issues to them. That's why I've done well in the straw polls. Mondale does not have a clear message. It's muddled, it's muddied. He has so many priorities that it's hard to tell what he considers most important. He, in effect, says, I will do everything from A to Z. I don't think a president can. I say I will seek to do A and B, peace and jobs. I don't know what John Glenn's message is. I asked him in the debate in New Hampshire recently, John, why are you running for president? It's just not clear what he would give absolute priority to and what he would seek to accomplish. There was a real difference on Grenada. I opposed the day of the invasion. Mondale and Glenn canceled their speeches that day and made no comment. The second day, they made comments that were hard to understand. At the end of the week, Glenn said, I support the invasion. It was necessary to save the students. I dispute that view. Mondale said, since the press couldn't cover the invasion, I don't know whether it was good or bad. I think you need more leadership and decision-making capacity on the part of one who would lead our country. Finally, I have the best base, California. It's the best base because it has the most people, and therefore 18% of the votes needed to be nominated in the convention and 18% of the votes needed to be elected in the Electoral College. I would not trade that base for the nomination for Minnesota's smaller base or Ohio's smaller base. I will have those votes at the convention. In the general election, It's generally said that a Democrat must carry the South or do well in the South or the West to win. Traditionally, a Democrat can do well in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, and other swing or traditionally Democratic states. But if you don't do well in the South or the West, you don't win. I don't know who will do best in the South. Maybe nobody, because that is Ronald Reagan's stronghold. If anybody can do well in the West and beat Ronald Reagan, first of all, in California, I can. I hold all the vote-getting records in California, first Democrat ever elected to a third term in the history of the state. I led Ronald Reagan in 1980 by 200,000 votes. In 1974, he wanted to run for the Senate. His term as governor was over. He wanted the base of a Senate seat to run for the presidency, but he would have had to run against me. And according to his political guru, Lim Nofziger, quoted in the press at the time, he did not run against me because he was afraid I might beat him. So I'm the first person who's ever scared him out of a political race. That's 47 electoral votes in California that I have a better chance to win than anyone else. Likewise, I have a better chance in Oregon, Washington, Montana, Idaho, New Mexico, and other western states. That's 70 or 80 electoral votes that I have a better chance to win against Ronald Reagan than anyone else. I do not know of a single state in the Union, including Minnesota, that Mondale is more apt to win than I am in a general election contest. So I believe that's a compelling reason to support me. Let me say to you finally that I need your help, and perhaps you need to help me if you want a president that can end this arms race. Nobody else in the race will give it the priority that I intend to as president. You are, of course, talented people. You would not be in the Harvard Law School were you not. And I know it keeps you very busy. You have a very heavy load here. But if you can join many other students from this and other campuses who have agreed to help me in the Massachusetts primary, which comes soon, and to help me in canvassing in New Hampshire, going up on weekends, going up over the holidays, going up whenever you can, to help us find the voters that will vote for me in that all-important first primary in the nation, that could be a very significant part of leading to a strong showing in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. I must do well there. Those are early tests. If you do not do well there, you're not likely to do well in the rest of the nation. But if you get off to a flying start in Iowa, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, you are very much in business and have a chance to win. With your capacities, you could do a tremendous amount to enhance the prospect that I will show strength and that it will be demonstrated that a candidate committed to the cause of peace and nuclear sanity in an age of great uncertainty and danger, that could be a very significant part in the making of the president in 1984. Let me finally say that California has produced three presidents so far, Herbert Hoover, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and I say we can do better. Thank you very much. Thank you.